Thank you for tuning in to the Head Game Podcast, powered by Mindful Athlete Training, where you grab an inside look into the heads and minds of the high performer. Learn what they do and how they think to help you take control of your own head game. Patty Collins is the United States Government Publishing Office's Deputy Director and its Chief Operating Officer. She oversees plant operations, security and intelligent documents, official journals of government and customer services. Prior to joining GPO in May 2020, Patty retired as a colonel following a 24-year career in the United States Army, where she spent 7 of those years with the Joint Special Operations Command, where she was deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan. A pioneer in her field, she was one of the small number of women to serve in special operations, and was the first woman in the Department of Defense to complete the military freefall jumpmaster course. She has experience in information technology, knowledge management, strategic leadership, and organizational change. In 2006, following her return from Iraq to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, she was unfortunately hit by a car while riding her bike to work. The injury was so severe, Patty elected to have her leg amputated below the knee. And upon rehabilitation, she continued her military service for an additional 9 years, which included a deployment to Afghanistan. In 2014, she became the Chief Information Officer to the Joint Force Headquarters Military District of Washington, National Capital Region, and retired from active duty in 2015, joining the McChrystal Group as a principal consultant focusing on leadership development in the public and private business sectors. Patty also competed as a triathlete in the 2016 Summer Paralympics in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Please welcome Patty Collins to the Head Game. Tell us, without hesitation, what has been your most challenging moment in your life? Because you've done a lot.
Yeah. I will say in 2006, after I sustained a pretty big injury when I was struck by a car, I had not yet made the decision to amputate, but I was in the darkest place of my life. And it was probably the pivotal moment of me discovering what mental fitness was, because if I were to grade myself where I was at that point, it would be like an F minus. And I didn't even really know what it was, but I will say I definitely diagnosed depressive and I was hopeless and that I couldn't see a way out. And backing up just a little bit, I had a fair amount of success in my life and in my career. And I equated it to, in many instances, I was about as physically capable as the men. Not better, but I could hang with them. And so in my mind, the way I identified myself was, I'm not super smart, I'm not super talented, but I'm physically about as good as they are. And therefore, I have earned my way into some of these assignments and some of these jobs and some of these opportunities. And I think after my accident and then depression and not having the mental skills to find my way out of that, that was the most challenging part of my life. And I didn't really know initially how to get out of that place.
When you say you actually, prior to you making the decision to amputate your leg, first of all, I can't even imagine being in that headspace of losing a limb. Now here we are talking about you actively having a choice. Can you just let us peer in a little bit more as to what that experience entailed? What were the things that you were weighing to make that decision? Incredibly difficult decision.
Yeah. So I guess to set the stage a little bit, I had returned pretty recently from Iraq without even a paper cut. I was selected early for a promotion, which was very unexpected. And I was at a moment in my life when I was not shy on self-confidence. That's how I like to describe that moment. I was feeling pretty good about me. And 2 days later, I was struck by a car riding my bike to work. I sustained a significant injury to my lower left leg, and the prognosis was grim. It was, you are not going to walk without significant pain. You're never going to run again. Your opportunity for activities is golf and gardening. And that was the phrase from my orthopedic surgeon is golf and gardening. And I said, I don't even like those right now. And so I didn't know how to move forward from there. And I was also in the early process of adopting my son. And I'll fast forward to a happy ending of he'll be 16 next month. So that's awesome. And that's been marvelous. But
it's marvelous until they get their driver's license, Patty. Then
we are having driving lessons now. Actually, we have one right after this podcast. So I'll stay in my headspace when that happens.
You can counsel me on that off air afterwards.
But I was in a place of hopelessness and not knowing how to move forward. Meanwhile, I was working with people who had lost limbs or had significant traumatic injuries from war, from training, from a variety of things. And they were in various levels of rehabilitation where some were kind of getting it back. Some were really struggling with addiction and, you know, head trauma. And some were completely rehabilitated and moving forward, deploying again and really amazing. And just looking around them, I felt like I was in a room, I was in an organization full of high achievers, and I felt stuck. Like I couldn't make a decision on where was I going next? How was I going to get out of this space? And I had thought a lot about amputation. I think when I was at my lowest of low, I hadn't really communicated that to medical professionals yet, because it seemed really scary to communicate that to someone and say, this is what I think I might want to do.
To what degree, though, is that did you weigh that risk in your mind? Like, so when you spelled out the way that you did, again, just to backtrack a little bit for the listening audience, talk to us a little about where you were physically just prior to your accident, as far as your level of competition, the intensity by which you were competing. What did those things look like, which I'm sure had to weigh against your ultimate decision of what you could or could not do with two fully functioning limbs versus one which was partially not fully functioning?
My job was fairly physical. I was a military free fall jumper, so I was a parachutist. And that was sort of an expectation of my job.
Were you the first woman to complete that, Patty?
I was not the first jumper. I was the first female jump master. So I had had some additional training and certification to figure out when to throw people out of the airplane, for lack of a better term. So yes, that's true. And I had indicated I had just come out on a promotion list. So there was, you know, in my mind, there was a plan of you are going to command a larger scale organization. You are going to run down the street with them and you're flag waving and all these things. You know, I was an avid triathlete, a little bit of a bike racer, a big runner in the woods. I would say I was a competitive age grouper. I was in my late 30s at that point. So, you know, I wasn't winning any world championships, but that's how I defined myself. That was also my first choice of I had a rough day or I had, you know, a bad conversation with someone. The way I would clear my mind is go for a run in the woods. And that was immediately gone. And I didn't realize until partway through my injury, after several months of not having any real physical activity, that physical activity had been part of my life since I was 12 years old. You know, when I was started as a high school runner. And so not having that chemistry in my body any longer also took a significant toll. And I didn't recognize that at that point in time.
What cued you to recognize that for yourself, to identify like, okay, this was a part of my life. This is just a piece of me that I'm missing. Like, what was the cue? Was there a moment? Was there something that you recognized that just created that shift for you?
I mean, there was a little bit of, in the depressive state, of obsessing over how was this going to be. And I spent an awful lot of time worrying about what I didn't have. And it took me a while to figure out, how about making a list of what you do have? And I went to see a therapist. And I was very fortunate that it was super accessible in the organization where I served. You know, it was literally walking distance from my office. And that was super helpful for me. I didn't have a lot of experience with a mental health provider. They were in a lot of organizations where I served, mostly helping us identify the type of candidate we wanted to hire, not necessarily helping us be stronger. That certainly changed after 9/11, and people started coming home different than how they left. And so their role absolutely changed. But I think the willingness to just lay all my cards on the table and saying, I am not okay. And I need to unpack, you know, what's going on between my brain and why I'm feeling the way I'm feeling. And so I think my therapist at the time probably helped me just through some conversations about how do you define yourself? and helped me understand that that was so much a part of my life, not just physically so I felt good, but it had such an impact on mentally how I felt.
Did you naturally go to, when you considered all of your options of whether or not to amputate your leg, did you actually go to in your mind that space of, once I choose to do this, once I come to a full recovery, these are the things I see myself doing again? Where did you go mentally to sort of assist with that decision? Often we can, when we can project to the end, it helps us take those first few difficult steps in any process.
Yeah, that, I mean, that was a lot of it of what could this be? So when I think about, I was working with people who had lost a limb and who were deploying again, or one person I would see running on the treadmill every morning. And I felt so fortunate that I could sit down and talk to them and say, tell me what's great and tell me what's not great. And out of the two that I spoke with, one was an elective and one was a traumatic injury. The elective was, you know, there was a traumatic injury and he tried to do limb salvage for a long period of time. But I remember a very pivotal conversation of sitting in an office with Bob and saying, tell me the worst thing about having one limb. And he said, it just made me laugh because of the perspective of it. He said, when I get in a helicopter with the rest of the assaulters, I can't bend my legs really close into my body. So I need a little bit more space just because of the way my prosthesis is designed. So I can't get as small. Therefore, I take up more room and I feel badly. That was his, this is why this is terrible. And so when I listened to that perspective, what I heard was, you're getting in a helicopter, you're going on objectives, you're doing the things that you were trained to do. If this is your inconvenience, that's pretty great. And that was his perspective as well. And it took him a while to get to the place where he was. But when I had that conversation with him, I said, well, this seems pretty minor in the grand scheme of things. And I looked at it from the perspective of, these are all the things I have the opportunity to regain, not all the things that I won't have. So it was a completely different mindset. And so when you even asked me, you even said when we started, I can't imagine how hard that decision was. And when I distill it down, it was, what do you want to do? And what are you willing to do to get that? And then it seemed not that hard also. I just had a conversation with my son recently because I had commented to him, we never really talked about mom having one leg. When he was adopted, I had already amputated and that was just normal life. And he said, I never thought it was unusual or strange that you had one leg and other moms didn't. And then the other thing that was interesting is he said, I don't know if this is intentional or just sort of happened. I have a lot of close friends with a disability. And I'm sure that some of that had to do with you or my mom. And I saw you go through life this way and not, you weren't weird or strange or unusual. And so seeing someone else of my classmates, it didn't make it scary for me or unusual or someone that I didn't want to associate with. I was more comfortable in that environment.
The normalization of it, right? That's critical in any piece. And we were fortunate to get to meet you in a setting that kind of warranted both a physical and mental mindset. We were on the Traverse 4 days in Montana, you know, over 30 miles, over 10,000 feet of elevation. And I think that's an interesting setting to meet somebody because it forces us to kind of build this bond and trust one another and challenge one another and communicate with one another. But to get to that point, we're talking about the incident, we're talking about the moment, this journey that you went through to finally, when we finally got to meet you, you know, what was that first step like? Because you go on to go to Rio as a Paralympian. How do you get involved in that? How are you like, I'm finally turning my mindset around. I'm getting help. I'm getting support. Now I want to be an Olympian. Like, how do you make that jump? How do you make that transition in life? Is that something that you're always thinking about? Do you want to be Olympian when you were a kid?
I mean, I think every kid probably watches the Olympics and is like, oh my goodness, that would be so great. I like to say I was a talented age group athlete. I was not phenomenal. I was a super talented para athlete. So that almost gave me a different opportunity. I think it was sort of interesting how it happened. I wanted to get back into sports. Obviously, I wanted to do triathlon again. I wanted to do some other things. And I know people listening may not think this, but being a baloney amputee is not that big of a deal. There's an adjustment for sure. And there are there are some inconveniences here or there, but it isn't the big of the deal. I didn't need a lot of modifications with my bicycle or things like that. You have to learn to swim without a prosthetic, but that's not, I was a swimmer before, so it wasn't super hard. Running took a bit to learn. So I think because I wanted that back, it was important for me to kind of check some blocks of if you can do the following things and you are officially back to where you were, which is such a funny thing that we do with ourselves, especially as we age. You know, if I could weigh this amount or I could run this far or whatever, which is just silly because our environment continuously changes. But there were a couple things in my mind that if I can do this, then I am officially back. And so I did it. I probably did a triathlon less than a year later, and it was pretty great. And then I think the military does a pretty good job with connecting veterans with significant injuries to a lot of resources and programs to keep them engaged, whether it's learning something new or just continuing down the path that they had. And so I was introduced to the Challenge Athletes Foundation. And then I was contacted almost blindly by a coach for US Paracycling. And he said, hey, we kind of know who you are. We know you cycle. We'd like to offer you some free coaching, and we would like you to go to a race, and we would like you to meet these times. I said, oh, okay. And so that was kind of fun because someone's giving you a structured training plan, and I had cycled competitively, but this was like a little bit more of upping the game.
This is the Patty I know and love. It's like, okay, USA, you know, Paralympics just called me. It was like, hey, let's do some trial. Let's like work together a little bit. You're just like, yeah, you know, that would seem like a nice time. It seemed like a good opportunity. I feel like people would be freaking out, but that's awesome. And that's so you, which I love. So
actually, when I got the initial email, my response was, I'm a battalion commander. So I'm, you know, I'm leading 700 soldiers. I'm a mom. I am over 40. You know, I work 60 hours a week. But if we can fit a training schedule in here, I will give it a go and try to do it. That was like literally my response. And so I think the fortuitous thing that happened was, this was 2012. Paratriathlon Nationals was in Austin, Texas that year. I was stationed at Fort Hood, and they had just announced that it would be a Paralympic sport in 2016. That was really my love. And I was like, well, Nationals is, it's an hour down the road. How can I not go and do this race? So I went and I did the race. I happened to win. And then I went to Worlds that year, and I won a world championship in 2012. So that was all kind of ridiculous. Like, it just, it's not that it wasn't hard, but it just was like, wait a minute, this is ridiculous. I think that was really, wow, there's a dream that has been born right here. And that's pretty amazing. That's how it started. And I think as I got closer to Rio, like, I think like any sport that is, it's either a new Olympic or new Paralympic sport, it gets more competitive every year. Athletes are coming out of the woodwork, or they're, you know, they're out of high school and now their body's really starting to develop and they are super fast. And so, full disclosure, I was teetering on the edge, headed to Rio at 47 years old. Literally, I was competing with girls who were 18. So I knew, like, this is your shot. This is your one shot. It's never going to happen for you again. You got to go all in. And so I had retired from the Army. A lot of things lined up really perfectly. I retired in 2015, and I spent the next year training full time. And that was a gift that the moon and the stars just lined up. I had the financial resources to take a year off. I had coaching, I had some support, and it was kind of a like, it's a do or die. You're going to go and you're going to go this year, or you're going to say, I gave it everything I had. So that's how that happened.
And once you get there, yeah. What's that like once you get there and you realize that this is the opportunity of a lifetime, and you were fortunate enough to get the coaching, time off. You know, there's a certain thing about cosmic alignment and timing when it comes to the human performance endeavors. Even when we track ourselves all the way back to our earliest achievements, sometimes people get hurt in providing other people an opportunity to do something that they wouldn't have, or a coach might come and go. There's a turnover with staff. Once you're there and you realize that it's all kind of fallen into place, what was that like for you? What was your approach like? Did you see every day as a gift? Did you see more as you owed it to yourself?
I think it was mixed. I think you bring up a good point where opportunity, I like how you said that, like, you get a new coach or somebody gets hurt and now you're the next person in line. And I think, you know, I like the phrase, I believe in luck, but the harder you work, the luckier you get. So I can sit here and say all the moon and stars aligned and this happened and there I went, but I worked really hard to get there. And, you know, even financially, like I knew this is something I wanted. So I started a year out like, okay, here's some cross-cutting measures or things that you're going to do so that you can afford to live this life for a year. And having the resources available to me, some of them you had to ask for, right? You had to ask, you had to work on if there was going to be a little bit of sponsor dollars or a little bit, things like that. Like, so there was a bit of, and that was hard for me to have the confidence to sell myself. And that's something I struggle with to this day. I think a lot of people do of, if you don't ask, the answer is always no, but why not you? And that's a hard thing for me to wrap my mind around is why not me? But I think, yes, a lot of things worked out really well for me, but I put myself in that place as well.
The journey into any Olympics is always fascinating to me because the mindset is so do or die because it only happens once every 4 years. And especially if that's your one sport and where you were in your life, right? You're like, this is now my only shot to do this. How did that play out? Because, you know, we really haven't touched too much on your military background as well. Did that play a role into that mindset, to that regimen mindset? Or, you know, did that kind of help you to get to a place where you were like, okay, like, I'm going to grind, I'm going to put this out there? Or is that just something that you've always had? Where is that mentality built up that you were able to then apply? Or was that something that you've learned over time?
I think if a lot of it comes from your childhood and how you're brought up. And my parents were pretty good about commitment. Whatever you choose to do, either you're going to do it for the whole season, you're going to go to every practice, and you're all in. It's not, you can't like halfway do something. That's just not who they were. So that's not who we were. I think joining the military certainly was an easy fit for me. But then if I look at my career path at about the halfway point of my career, I made some choices to try to go to more selective organizations that required an assessment, a selection, a psychological evaluation, a pretty intense hiring process. And I used to joke around and say, I'm not the best person you could have hired, but I'm the best person that applied the day you were looking. And, you know, I say that jokingly, but it's true that I'm amazed how many people will say after the fact, I would have loved to have done that. And then when you say, did you apply? No. So you have to have the courage to say, it might be a no, but you're not going to know if you don't try. So there's got to be a little bit of, or a lot of, like, if I gave it my best shot and it wasn't me, that's okay. But now I know. But you got to have the courage to try. And so I think that was kind of the story of my career. I could also say, me choosing to amputate my leg was like, I had the courage to try and see how this was going to work out. And at the time, limb salvage for only 10 months in the Army was ridiculous. That was really fast. That was a quick decision. That's not how it was normally done. And again, the moon and stars aligned in that I got to see a doctor who was an orthopedic surgeon, and as it turned out, was on the 1980 boycotted Olympic team. And he believed in me, and he spent a lot of time talking to me, and he said, I am much more concerned with what's between your ears than your x-ray. And I don't think that's a normal orthopedic surgeon response. So I felt extremely fortunate. And then when I went and Googled him and I found out his past, I was like, oh, wow. You know, so maybe that's the moon and stars aligning, or maybe that's me.
Another moment of timing. Exactly. Another moment of timing. Yeah, with your alignment, and right, and the harder that you work, the better your luck improves. And you know, we're talking about you as an athlete, but I can't overlook the fact that your highest rank was colonel. And you mentioned something quick, like little blip on the radar, that you were responsible for 700 soldiers. Yeah. What was that head game like for you? And I certainly am not defining you, Patty, by your injury, but I find that being an amputee and going through the endeavors that you did, once as a high performer, then in the military, just if you could look at, you know, the before and after picture, was there ever a moment when I looked down and realized that my finest suit isn't the way that I want to look, that might give me, you know, a moment of insecurity? I can't imagine what it would be like after you make the very difficult decision, right, with your leg. Was there ever a time where you just felt insecure about the job that you were being asked to do?
I never felt insecure about the job I was being asked to do. I did go through a period of being insecure about what I physically look like. And it was very early on. And I didn't realize it until after the fact. I was living in North Carolina. It was summertime. And I would go to church and I would wear pants. And in my mind, I was wearing pants because I didn't want the older members of the congregation to pity me. Right? That's what I told myself. I don't want them to pity me. I'm fine. In actuality, I wasn't ready to own who I was. And so it took me, one of my friends remarked, maybe a couple years later, we were getting into an elevator, you know, a group of people, and we got out and he said, "You don't even notice that people look at your leg all the time when we're walking around, when we're in an elevator, whatever." And I said, I don't anymore. In the beginning, I probably did. But then I think you get to a point where you're like, I just have to own who I am.
Is that a moment, Patty? An accumulation over time? Is it you wake up one day and you don't mind as much as what other people think? Is it a shift in perception?
Lee, I think it was the more I was able to do, the further I could walk, when I could start running, you know, things of that nature, the more confidence I had, and then it mattered less to me. So I don't think there was a moment in time. There was the retrospect of me realizing, oh, that's not what that was about. You didn't want, you know, you weren't being thoughtful of them. You were being protective of you.
Yeah. That's a common phenomenon, right? Even when we feel unsure or insecure in a particular moment, we'll kind of project it onto others of, oh, I'm making sure that they're okay, right? Or, you know, people pleasers, right? They'll define themselves as people pleasers, that they're doing them for other people. But in reality, it's to satiate them or to avoid anxiety within themselves. So, you know, I think that's a very common element. And I think it's really important for people to hear, too, of, you know, as you started to kind of push your limits, as you started to find your own confidence, you know, that you were able to make that realization more of that's what I was doing.
Yeah. But back to your question, Lee, there was never a point in time where I thought I couldn't do my job because of my physical disability. And when I look back on this whole, you know, period of, you sent me some questions in advance, the thing I am most proud of is staying in the military for another 9 years after I lost my leg and not having any limitation. It changed me as a leader. It made me a better leader, for sure. It made me a much more empathetic.
How did it make you a better leader?
It made me more empathetic because I will say that younger me could be a little bit judgy on what people could and could not do, or their motivation levels toward their work or their performance or what have you. And I never gave much thought to what might be going on with them. You know, what's going on with their personal life? Is there something in the way? I never asked, but that was not normally the first thing that came into my mind. It was like, wow, Hunter is just not performing. That would be my, right? After I, you know, went through my own process and rehabilitation, what have you, I remember starting my job, my young soldiers would want to come into my office all the time, which is a little bit unusual. And generally they wanted to share stuff with me of what was going on with them. And I think they looked at me and said, that person's probably gone through some stuff. Maybe she understands my stuff. And it was all different things. It was, you know, my mom is sick, or I'm not having a great time in my relationship at home, or whatever the case may be. There were a lot of reasons. And I think that was when I realized, like, that was my superpower, that people felt comfortable coming to me. Now, it's not necessarily my place to solve everyone's problem, right? I can turn you around and give you some resources and say, and on your way out, go see your first line supervisor and make sure everyone knows, right? But that I realized that I was perhaps pretty quick to judge in the past and talk more and listen less. And so that was different, and that was good. I understood that Fort Hood has 30,000 soldiers, right? There was only one woman with one leg that would run down those streets, right? Everyone knew who I was. I didn't know who everyone was, right? I knew my 700 soldiers and maybe a couple of their friends, but everyone knew me. And I got to the point of, you know, we all go through the why me, why did whatever happen to me. If something I do or say, or someone hears something and that motivates them to make a change in their life or to help them through a troubling time, great. That's okay. That's totally fine. Whatever I went through was totally worth it. If someone can take a grain of motivation from that or inspiration from that and move forward with their life.
So Patty, when, you know, we talk about your career just from A to Z, let's backtrack just a little bit. Let's get to like the pre-military Patty. Talk to us about your key moments in your life that you would say really contribute to your overall perspective. You know, we want to know more about when there are building blocks in everyone's life that contribute to what we achieve. And at a certain level, we're deemed a high performer by either the things that we do, the company that we keep, those key markers. But we really are trying to kind of encapsulate what it is about a person's ability to handle more mental capacity in key moments. Talk to us a little bit about your life in general and what key moments you think contribute to that.
Yeah. Okay. I think the value of hard work was a key lesson as a kid. I did grow up in the family of, you did not watch cartoons on Saturday or lie in bed. You're up, you're out, you're moving. Here are your chores or whatever that looked like. I had a summer job when I was 13. All my siblings did as well. So it wasn't abnormal. My dad had two jobs and we were just a family that worked hard. And I think the value of hard work can never be diminished because we're all given certain gifts and talents, but you can overcome a lot of, you know, you can overcome a lot of natural ability by hard work, right? And we know that. That I think was definitely one of them. My dad used to say, and I'll paraphrase, if you want to be better at fill in the blank, hang out with people who are better than you. And so I hung out with kids who got better grades than me. I was a cross country and track runner. I was terrible. I mean, I was not a talented runner by any means. I was very much a middle of the pack and bottom of the middle of the pack, but that's where I wanted to be. I think it was my junior year in track. I won an award because I was the only kid that in 3 years of track practice, I'd never missed a workout. Never. And you know, one would think, wow, your trajectory should be much better. And there was definitely improvement. But I remember my track coach saying that to me. And he was a pivotal person in that, you know, way back in 1986, we had individual personalized workouts. This is how fast you need to run the 100, 200, 400, 800, every workout. And it didn't matter if you were going to be first or you were probably going to get lapped in the 3200. Everyone got that much attention. Because I think in his mind, he's like, nobody deserves anything less because they're performing less. If you are willing to come here and put in the work, you're going to get my best effort right back. So I think those were some pretty key lessons to me. Hanging out with people better than you at whatever that was, and a work ethic, for sure.
You know, the reason why I ask is because I think, especially in today's world, when you think about social media and you think about how so much information on a positive note is shared instantaneously, it starts to present the framework for young persons that, you know, achievement is easy and finding yourself in the limelight is not if but when. But, you know, I've said to my children for years, no one's paying attention to anyone when they're just getting started, when they're struggling, when they're failing. We've heard it said 1,000 different ways, you know, when you're working the hardest, when no one's paying attention, and, you know, how we can make comparisons to things like that. I just think it's important from a storytelling perspective that once you're identified as a high performer, that there's some recognition as to what you did to get there. You know, when we talk about the role of being more mentally fit, now that you are where you are and you're at this stage in your life and your career, talk to us a little bit about what kind of things you do, you take stock in to get yourself mentally fit and to keep you there.
Yeah. And a lot of it I learned from you guys. I think as anyone ages on the physical side, right, our body does not respond the way we would like it to all the time, right? And there are tons of reasons for that. So I think there is a lot to overcome mentally that raises your physical game. Some of that is really spending time reflecting about what are your goals for the coming year? What do you want to do, whether that's physically, whether that's a job promotion, whether that's a relationship you want to work on? Being able to define what those are and being more reflective. The older I got in my military career, I started realizing you need time to think. And it's not so much of getting things from my inbox to my outbox, it's thinking. And my thinking time was, you know, right now I'm a bike commuter, so I think when I ride my bike to work, I think about work, I think about projects, I think about what's next. That's definitely time well spent. I think finding a community with not necessarily similar goals, but a similar mindset and sharing with them is really critical. And I didn't appreciate the value of that. I think I did as an athlete because you're talking to other athletes because you've got some similar stuff. But finding like-minded people that really want to work on self-improvement, sharing what your goals are, sharing where you're getting stuck. I have a friend who's an executive coach and she hosts something. It costs like $10. It's called an Hour of Power, right? And you zoom in, you know, we're on a Zoom channel, and for an hour, you are committed to doing your own work, right? So you're like, it's like your accountability partner. And it's funny because you think, oh, I don't need that. Yes, you do, right? That's $10 well spent. If I'll spend $10 and I could sit with Lee and Hunter and we're just going to do our own work, we don't even work in the same field, right? But we're just on camera, even if we got headphones in and we're working, I am accountable to you to show up and be productive, just like you are. And I think community and shared people with shared mindsets is super important. And it goes back to my dad saying, hang out with people who are better than you, right? Why hang out with like-minded people that have similar aspirations is super important. Sleep and recovery is really important to me. And, you know, I know you did the Berkman as well before we went out and hiked in Montana. I realized that I am like the family dog. I need time outside every day. I need, you know, not necessarily a nap, but I need rest every day. And I need white space in my calendar. I can't fill my calendar from sun up to sundown. I'm not as productive that way.
Yeah, I really connect with too, finding people that are better than you. I think, you know, there's a few moments today in our conversation, we're talking about a little bit of vulnerability, right? Really being vulnerable with ourselves. And that is a huge vulnerability aspect, to be open to that moment, right? Vulnerability can be taken in multiple ways, I guess. More so it's openness to failure, openness to challenge, and to know that, hey, you know what? I might fall on my face a few times, right? I may be blown by a few times, but whenever I'm chasing that, whenever I'm reaching for that, my family recently had a party and my cousins were there and the older brother and the younger brother, and the younger brother was just constantly chasing, constantly running after the older brother. And I'm like, the younger brother's going to become a better athlete because he's just constantly moving even since a young age, right? Yeah. So it's you're seeking that challenge out. You're constantly seeing what am I capable of by comparing yourself to those higher people. But it's the challenge of that, right? What are they doing that I like? I always say, you know, if somebody's starting out in their career or mid in their career, look for people who you aspire to be and recognize what they do. That doesn't mean not to forge your own path, but really to recognize what is Patty Collins doing, right? What is Lee Picarello doing, right? What are the people that we aspire to be like doing, and how do I take that in? Because I think that's critical as we develop to try to get to that next level.
Patty, when you were talking earlier about how you've come to know yourself and, you know, needing white space, I love that phrase, and needing time outside, you know, there are certain variables that when we think about being mentally fit, you know, we emphasize core concepts like strength and endurance. What kind of leaps off to me is that you know yourself very well. Insight has got to be at the top of your list. Have you always been that way? Is that an accumulation of your life, of your career, your athletics? Talk to us about your insight.
No, it has not been something I've always known. And I think there's a joy in life experience, or age, if you want to call it age, is if you open your mind to learning, there's always something out there to learn about yourself, about others, about whatever. And I think if, I mean, similar to what Hunter said, is like, look at what other people are doing that you have aspirations toward, and what can you learn from that? I think I would have previously said, if you didn't have white space, you were lazy. I was not someone who put time to think on a calendar. And some of that was jobs were easier when you're, you know, when you're, I won't say they're easier. They're different when you're younger. They're more shorter decision-making. And then as you gain experience, you're making more strategic decisions. So you need to mull around thoughts and ideas and things like that. So I think I have really appreciated learning as I age, how my own machine, the machine of Patty works, how the mind of Patty works. And it's exciting. Yeah, I'm enjoying it.
I always like to ask the guests something nuanced. I'm a very curious person. I like to learn. It's something that drives me. So I always like to try to find something nuanced. So if it's an athlete, like, what's a nuance of their sport? If it's somebody who's an entrepreneur, what's a nuance that they do on a daily basis? So I'm going to just ask you, and more so, I'm going to go with the triathlon here, as you've spent time in the Olympics with that. What's a nuanced detail that maybe the average person wouldn't know that, like, you have to either be mindful of or strategic about that plays into being effective at that sport?
The amount of free speed that's available in a race. And I think at any level, when you get to the more elite level, there's no stone that you can leave unturned, right? That's not a new thing. But I think the nuance of practicing the little things and getting really good at the little things. And that's everything from how many hours do you wake up before a race? How do you set up your transition area? Practicing your transition area over and over and over and over. I think also, even on race day, recovery begins the moment you cross the finish line. Those, I think, are the nuanced things that put someone above someone else.
Yeah, what's that level of detail like? You talk about the transition area. Did you have a particular, like, I'm putting my shoe here, you putting the bike here, like, I'm grabbing this handle. What are you doing? Are you breaking that down to that detail, or is it just grabbing?
You're breaking it down to, what gear is my bicycle in? Where are my pedals? You know, where's my left pedal? Where's my right pedal? Do I have one shoe clipped in, both shoes clipped in? What does that look like when I come into the transition area? Generally, you grab your helmet first because you're not allowed to touch your bike until your buckle is fastened on your helmet. And so all those little things, and my coach would put it on my training calendar, 20 minutes transition drills. And maybe it would be, okay, you're going to transition. You're running across the parking lot. Maybe you have your goggles and your swim cap in your hand. Sometimes I wear my wetsuit because you got to practice getting out of that too, right? And you just, maybe you spend a half an hour doing that. And when you look at times, I know when I was practicing them regularly and when I wasn't, because I look at my race times and I look at my transition times versus my peers. And I was like, you gave up 30 seconds here. You gave up 8 seconds there. You were 9 seconds behind someone. Well, you threw that away on free speed.
Free speed. I love that. So it's the detail of excellence. The one that just stuck out was like, oh, I have to know what gear it's on. I wouldn't even have thought that was a thing. So I love that. And thanks for kind of sharing a little bit of insight into that. Because I think it's always interesting of how high performers see things just different in their particular fields.
But I think, Hunter, it's translatable to life, right? You have Absolutely. A meeting, you're running the meeting. How are you prepared? When does the agenda go out, et cetera, things like that. Those are the details that, when they become a pattern of your behavior that you always do it, someone else coming in having never seen it, it's like, wow, that was a well-run meeting.
Well, you say, you know, it's 30 seconds here, 15 seconds here. And if you can grab enough of those in your life, right, whether that's just a slightly more successful meeting or, you know, a little bit more efficient in this particular area where you're still getting things done, but you're just grabbing that free speed of life, that's critical. But it takes that mentality to be detailed. I really like what your coach did is it forces you, work on it, put it in your plan. Right? Don't just think it's going to happen overnight. And I think that's an important mindset to take away as well.
I'm listening to you kind of talk to Hunter. And one of the things that we emphasize is that, you know, life is a performance. And this concept, this role of mental fatigue is not if but when it shows up. And then I think about you talking about a triathlon. The concept of a triathlon for me, I was always an athlete in your traditional football, basketball, baseball. And if triathlons to me, my entire life was always something that I would identify as, well, that's something that I could never do because I've never been a long distance runner. I don't have the capacity for that. I was never particularly interested in riding my bike when I was a kid. And I am actually a pretty good swimmer because my dad was in that arena and I grew up with that. But I was like, you know, one out of three, that's not for me. So when you think about triathlon and you think about this trifecta of athletic experience and this conglomerate, what are some of the mental challenges that you faced in making that transition, making that shift from one sport to the next in the manner in which the race mandates?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm positive you could do a triathlon. We'll talk more about that afterward.
Yeah, I was waiting for him to announce his first triathlon.
In Philly, every year, there's several probably. I think some of the skills that we worked on out in Montana, I think were super, super relevant because, let me try and break it down. So, you know, the beginning of a swim in a triathlon is, it's a free-for-all, right? It's a lot of people swimming on top of each other. Everyone's very amped.
I've heard that's madness. It can be madness.
And that's another thing that you train on that. You practice starts with a bunch of your friends in a very small confined area, and you intentionally try and swim on top. I mean, it's fun. It's super fun. But it also lowers your anxiety about it because the first time it happens, the first time you get kicked in the face and you lose your goggles, you're definitely off your game, and it's going to take a bit for you to get refocused. So there's certainly that. And then you're looking for the groove once you settle in of, I want some feet to draft off of because it's free speed and it's very legal. Once you're coming, I worked very hard on, don't think about the next event until you're getting to the next event. Stop thinking about the bike if you're still in the water, right? You can start thinking about that when you're running out of the water, but it's easy to kind of fast forward and, you know, kind of fall into the trap of, I'm not having a great swim. Oh, now I'm going to finish poorly instead of staying in the moment. And some of the work that we did on, I think it was the throwing the walking sticks and the walking around trying to distract, right? So you're aware of what's going on around you, but you can still remain focused on where you are. So a great example is you're coming out of transition, right? So you're done with the swim, you've removed your wetsuit, cap, goggles, you put on your bike helmet. Now you're leaving the transition area. Most likely you're leaving with a big group of people. So you've got to be aware of what's going on around you because it can be a little hectic also, but you're also focused on get to the mount line, get on your bike and, you know, move out in your own direction. So I think being able to stay in the moment, I probably do more self-talk on the bike than any other discipline. I like the bike the most, truly. I think I was a pretty strong cyclist. And it was kind of almost a continuous check-in of, are you going hard enough? Are you going hard enough? Are you going hard enough? That was my general mantra. Sometimes it wasn't. Sometimes it was, I'm coming into a corner, take the corner as technically smart as you can, because again, you want to come out of the corner fast. And if you make a bad turn, then you're losing a second or two here or there. And that does all matter. And then my coach used to say, suspend judgment. Don't start judging your race when you're still in the race. I mean, she liked to say suspend judgment till the next morning, which was super hard to do, but also very important. But she helped me really work on staying exactly where you are. And you can be aware of what's going on around you, but you've got to be able to stay in your race in your moment. And that's a life skill, right? I mean, you can look at, if you get caught up in the, you know, Twitter, Instagram reels or whatever, like that can be extremely distracting in any part of our lives.
Hits so close to me too, just thinking about looking for what's next, looking for that next thing, trying to prepare, but also really trying to master my swim, right? Master my bike and really be in that. But what you're saying too is, you know, suspending that judgment is focusing on that action.
Patty, when we talk about, you know, your physical preparation, and again, just for me, the concept of a triathlon is, you know, identify your objectives, you know, conceptualize a plan, make sure that it's attention to detail laden, and then try as best you can to follow it by the letter. But again, there's this role of mental fatigue that when it shows up, it starts to compromise our capacity. So that ability to stay in our lane while we're still mindful of the big race might get compromised. Has there ever been a time where your mental just let you down?
Sure. Yeah. I think it's probably starts with being physically tired. Because I think when you're training at a high level, you're always teetering on the edge, right? And either thinking, not taking recovery as seriously as you should, or you're flying into a race 2 days prior, right? And so some of my races were in South Africa or Europe or Australia. That's really not a fair amount of time to get your body set. And, you know, then you have little things go wrong, like my flight was delayed, or I am here, but my bicycle is not here. Okay, it shows up in time to race, but there is that little bit of time where you are, it's just taking a little bit of energy from you because you're worried about, I know it's going to show up, but until it does, until I have my hands on it and I put it together and I know that it runs well, I'm expending energy on this. And I did have a race like that. I'm sure I had more than one, but I do remember races like that. And it just, it's the little things that you would normally be able to overcome super easily that just become big things. And, you know, I think I remember one example where someone in front of me had fallen on their bicycle, and it should have been super easy for me to just move around, make a good turn and go on. And I kind of made it a big production, and I stopped and I got off my bike, and it was ridiculous. And looking back on it now, there were so many indicators that you weren't mentally 100% going into that event for a variety of reasons. And then there was the continued, you know, rest of the bike, I was beating myself up over my crappy turn, right? Which is just silly. Like, what? And I can look back on it now and go, that's just ridiculous. But at the time, I wasn't recognizing where I was.
And how do you put one foot in front of the proverbial other when that moment really comes to fruition and you realize, and that, because then what we're really talking about, what you're talking about, Patty, is that judgment, that self-judgment that still can come to us in the moments of performance that, as we know, then there's that downward spiral where we continue to then negatively focus, and it compromises our self-talk, which changes our physiology, which changes our energy, muscle tightness, right? It's this huge domino chain reaction. How have you practiced to catch yourself in that moment, to hit the pause button, to interrupt, and then do something different, literally take the off ramp?
I think some of my things, which are super common sense things, are, you know, you have a little beat yourself up over that. And then my next question to myself is, and what is the worst thing that's going to happen as a result? And it's always like nothing. Like, and so you blew 15 seconds. And so you didn't place where you wanted to place. Like, in the grand scheme of your big life, is this really the worst thing in the world? Probably not. Right. I think I had a friend challenge me to, he said, for a week, drive in the slow lane. Because I made a comment, I was like, I'm such a road rager, you know, if I have to drive to the office and, you know, deal with DC traffic. And he goes, try driving in the slow lane. And just, if you tell yourself, here is where I am and I'm here the whole time, it's not nearly as stressful. Of like, if someone cuts you off, you're like, what do I care? I'm in the slow lane. Like, this was my plan all along, is to stay in the slow lane. So I think recognizing something unplanned happened, can I overcome it? And just like, it's kind of, if I feel myself starting to kind of overreact and spiral, it's like, what's the worst thing that's going to happen? It's really nothing catastrophic. Like, okay. You know, kind of like almost like laughing at yourself. Like, are you really going to get upset over this?
Yeah, that's a cognitive strategy, you know, of the best case, worst case, most realistic is really what you're mentioning, of letting yourself go there, but saying, hey, wait a minute, if this is part of my plan, because of me being in this slow lane was with intention, with purpose of my own doing, then that catastrophic option really, it's not the perceived 10, it becomes more of a 6, right? And then therefore it allows us to continue.
Well, I think a critical piece too is to recognize, like, how do I shift that into all the scenarios of my life when I maybe haven't made that decision? I want to be in the fast lane, but somebody does cut me off, or somebody is going slow in the fast lane. I think that is when, like, our most chaotic moments happen. And I think that's really where our challenge moment occurs.
I think that's a really great point. I think it also can cause me to be reflective and say, did you do enough appropriate planning to not be in the slow lane? Because maybe I didn't, right? And then maybe that gives me the opportunity to go, okay, in the future, I'm going to do whatever in preparation.
That's the critical piece, right? To not dwell, we talk about the non-judgment, to not judge, not to beat ourselves up as a result of it, but to say, I'm a capable being and I can learn from this, right? It's not ideal. You can still be upset about it, but it's about learning from it and shifting from it that you're going to grow from.
You know, Patty, when we were on the Traverse in Montana this past June, I affectionately gave you a nickname as a lady warrior with a descriptive explicative lodged there in the middle. And I've shared this with Hunter. I've shared this with dozens of people since my return. And I just have to make mention of it. And I just want your kind of take on it. If you can maybe step outside of yourself for a moment and see it from another person's perspective, such as myself. Here I am. I prepared, I would say, on a scale of 1 to 10, about a 6, based on my climbing ability or my cardio prep. And there were moments where I was gassed, moments where altitude, you know, kind of has that effect on you that the spicy mango gummies could not overcome no matter what, you know. And here I am looking over at you saying, this person is doing what I'm doing with one leg. How in the world can I even remotely get upset with myself, have a bad attitude, complain about snowshoes? The list goes on and on and on. Did you ever have moments on the mountain of kind of like and it's not in an arrogant way, but did you ever have moments on the mountain like, I'm climbing this post injury, or is this just persona part of who you've become?
Yes, there were. I think it was when we were really close to the top of the peak on the third day, and I knew we were all going to make it. And that morning, for whatever reason, I was just feeling like probably better than normal. And I think I was near the front of the group, which was not where I was most of the time. And I felt really good, and I was like, "Heck yeah!" Because that was something. When Chris asked me to do it, I immediately said yes. And then I panicked because I was like, oh my goodness, you haven't had a pack on your back in 20 years. And P.S., you had two legs the last time you did that. So I will say my preparation was probably around the same grade as yours. I didn't know that I could walk that far and climb that much, carrying that much weight, and not have any sort of significant negative effects on my, you know, my residual limb or the functionality of my prosthetic or whatever. So I think it was, and I told Chris that. I was like, whoa, these are some things I haven't done. And Chris just said, oh, you'll be fine. You cycle a lot. You'll be fine. I think there's certainly a part of that that's been my persona probably my whole life, even before my injury of, I think I will call it a healthy amount of courage of, oh, heck yeah, let's just go do this. Why not? What's the worst that could happen, right? And I will say that I do factor in safety and risk and things like that, but I will tell you, I just came back from a week. I did a cycling trip down the coast of California with a nonprofit. It was a fundraiser, and I piloted a visually impaired person on a tandem. I had never ridden with him before. We were on a borrowed bike because I didn't fully appreciate tandems are generally made for the larger person sits in the front, taller person. I'm 5'6". My stoker was 6 foot tall. So we were on a borrowed bike, and we were going to spend 640 miles over 7 days together. And I didn't really know him. And I didn't think it was a big deal until people started asking me, how long have you and Walt been riding together? And I said, since Saturday morning, when we started the ride, right? And it didn't seem unusual to me. So I think that's a little bit of who I am. And I view that as a quality that I like about myself.
Is that really, you know, I hear you when you say that. That's a testament to who you are, but is that really just part of something that allows you to continue to face what most people would consider almost insurmountable challenges as just another option for you? Because there's so many descriptive adjectives that I can use to describe what you're saying. There's mental toughness. There's resiliency. There's a risk taker in you that all kind of has sort of morphed together in this wonderful, like, holistic pie that constitutes the things that you've done and the decisions that you've made. But I think it's so important to try to, for all of those people that are listening, that are either current high performers, that are aspiring, that are working through some type of adversity in their life, you know, what is it about? Is it crossing the proverbial finish line, Patty, that motivates you? Is it the process along the way and the reflection that comes with it? Can you put your finger on one variable?
I think it's always the journey. I even said this during my elite racing career. I didn't love racing. I loved training. I loved the hurt of seeing what you could do. The process of stringing several hard workouts together over and over and over. That I loved. Sharing it. I find it interesting that most of the sports I chose growing up were really individual sports, but I 100% know that they are all better shared. And so it kind of surprises me that I wasn't a team sport player. I told most of the group, I've done this ride down the coast once before. And I said, I don't think I could ever do it again, not piloting for someone, because I enjoyed sharing that journey with someone else. I would not hike in Montana for 4 days by myself because I would want to share it with you guys. I think the journey is my favorite part, but I also think somewhere along the lines there was a healthy dose of confidence in my psyche and courage.
Patty, tell us a little bit about any passion projects that you presently have going on. I know that you're involved with a lot. Talk to us a little bit more just about what you do in your downtime.
What you do in your free time? Cycling I'm pretty involved with, guiding for visually impaired athletes. And that's something I would never have thought to do before I had my own injury. And I tell the story of people were so helpful in wanting to support me get into whatever my next thing was post-injury that I thought, well, surely I could give back in some form or fashion as well. So that, like, giving someone that opportunity to go for a bike ride is super fun. And I've been doing that for about 7 years. So that's something that I will continue doing. I think I came out of the mountains a little bit. I think my big aha was not continuing to challenge myself necessarily physically. I know we just talked about a pretty big thing that I did, but I think there was definitely a, you know, leave your elite sports. I'm a 53-year-old woman athlete, so there's a lot of life changes, but it doesn't mean that you're done. It doesn't mean that you're not throwing some big goals on the wall. So I have some, I don't think I can announce it yet, but I have a bike sponsor, which seems ridiculous. So I'm going to be doing some big gravel races next year, which I'm super excited about. I feel very passionately about anything that helps someone with a physical disability get outside and do something. So I'm definitely involved in that. And then I'm also on the board for an organization in the North Carolina area that really works with service members and families about building resilience, and it's nature-based. It's doing things outside. And so I'm not intimately involved in what they're doing, but, you know, forest bathing and yoga and horseback riding and things like that to really work on. And I love that it's a family approach. It's not just a service member, because when things happen to a family member, it happens to the whole family. So that's a pretty great thing. And it's not open to someone who has sustained an injury. It's open to everyone at Fort Bragg. So I think that will definitely help build resilience, you know, prior to when you might need it. And then that's a lot of what you're about, is like, let's work out our mind before bad things happen, so we are better able to cope with whatever those things are. And I have a regular job.
And you have that too. So how do people contact Patty Collins? What's the best way?
Oh gosh. LinkedIn is probably a good way. Instagram, my handle is Heavy Bag of Gold. So it's HVYBAGOFGOLD. One of my favorite phrases is, my bag of gold is so heavy. So times when I want to complain about whatever, like, just keep in mind you're carrying a bag of gold. So, like, that's okay.
Either of those organizations, I know you talked about, what is it, the Challenge Fund? Is that correct?
It's the Challenge Athletes Foundation.
Challenge Athlete Foundation. So if anybody wanted to connect with that or donate, they could do so, just their website.
It's challengeathletesfoundation.org. And then the other one is Camp Resilience. And I honestly, it's probably just campresilience.com. I would have to look it up. It's based in North Carolina.
Oh, no problem. We'll put it down in the description below so people can click and link it. Yep, absolutely.
Well, Patty, we just want to thank you for your time. I know how insanely busy you are and your calendar. Glad that you etched out a little bit more white space for us. We miss you. It was great to reconnect with you.
You guys also.
And just, you know, with everything that you do, and your, I think your story is such an incredibly valuable one that needs to be told. And, you know, I told my wife sometime in around May that I had a feeling that going to Montana that was going to change my life. And you are a testament to that, as well as some other persons along the way.
Likewise. So
thank you so much for taking time out to speak to us on the Head Game.
My pleasure.
Have a good one.